Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We've been exploring the eukaryotes for a bit now, and today it's time for the grand finale, you could say. The animal kingdom, Animalia.
Right, and we're drawing heavily from Dr. Hoffman's lecture, which really walks us through the whole evolutionary sweep.
It does, and his central theme, right from the start, is pretty impactful.
Definitely. This idea that when animals appeared, they fundamentally changed the planet. He calls them highly portable eating machines.
That phrase really sticks. And because of that, the world became, in his words, a much more dangerous place to live.
Exactly. That mobility, that active consumption, it drives everything else we're going to talk about.
So let's get our bearings. How far back are we talking? When did these dangerous machines first appear?
Well, Dr. Hoffman points out we need to think deep time. The actual fossils of complex animals are younger, but the molecular data suggests the whole animal clade, metazoa, goes back maybe 770 million years.
770 million, wow. So that's actually older than land plants.
By a long shot, yeah. Hundreds of millions of years older. Their whole origin story, their first act, was completely underwater.
Okay, so looking at the evolutionary tree Dr. Hoffman presents,
yeah.
The most basic group, the one closest to the starting point.
Well,
that's the sponges, right? Phylum Porifera.
Exactly. Sponges are fascinating. They're likely the closest thing we have to what the earliest animals might have looked like. They are multicellular, definitely.
But critically, they don't have true tissues.
Right. No organized muscle tissue, no nerve tissue, none of that complex layering you see in almost all other animals.
And they're asymmetrical, which is also unusual. But Dr. Hoffman highlights this amazing cellular detail that links them back.
The choanocytes, the collar cells, they line the inside of the sponge.
Mm-hmm.
And they have these little flagella that beat to create a water current, pulling water in through the pores. That's why they're called pore bearers.
Okay.
But the amazing thing is, these choanocytes inside the sponge look almost identical to single-celled organisms called choanoflagellates.
Which are the closest single-celled relatives to all animals.
Exactly. It's like seeing the evolutionary precursor still operating right there inside the animal. It's incredible evidence.
So the flagella move the water. The collar cells grab tiny food particles through phagocytosis.
Yep. And then these other cells, amoebocytes, kind of crawl around and distribute the nutrients. Simple, but it works.
Okay, so after sponges, what's the next big evolutionary step Dr. Hoffman covers?
That would be the emergence of true tissues. And that brings us to the cnidarians.
Jellyfish, sea anemones, corals, that group.
Right. They have definite tissues like nerve nets and simple muscle fibers, but they don't really organize them into complex organs.
Still a pretty simple body plan, often just a sac with one opening.
Yeah, the gastrovascular cavity, mouth, and anus are the same hole, basically.
And a different kind of symmetry here too, right? Not asymmetrical like sponges.
Correct. They have radial symmetry. Everything's arranged around a central point, like spokes on a wheel. Think of a jellyfish or an anemone.
Which works fine if you're floating or stuck in one spot, but maybe limits more directed movement.
It does. And that difference, radial versus bilateral symmetry, is a major dividing line for almost everything else that follows. Bilateral symmetry is key for becoming a truly portable eating machine.
Okay, let's unpack that. Bilateral symmetry, having a left and a right side, a distinct front and back. Why is it so important?
Well, it allows for cephalization. You get a head end where sensory organs and processing power concentrate. It gives the eating machine a direction to travel in.
Makes sense. And tied into this move towards bilateral complexity are the germ layers, the sort of developmental blueprints. Dr. Hoffman groups them.
Yeah. Based on how many layers form during embryonic development, you've got diploblasts with two layers, the outer ectoderm and inner endoderm. Like the cnidarians.
And then triploblasts with three.
Right. Ectoderm outside, endoderm inside, and crucially, the mesoderm in the middle.
And that mesoderm is the real game changer.
Absolutely. The ectoderm makes skin and nerves. The endoderm makes the gut lining, but the mesoderm. That's where you get muscles, bone or cartilage, circulatory systems, reproductive organs, all the complex stuff in between. You need mesoderm for complex bodies.
And Dr. Hoffman stresses another key innovation for these triploblastic animals, the callum, the body cavity. Why is having an internal space so vital?
It's all about smooth operation and movement. Imagine trying to move if your muscles were grinding directly against your digestive tract every time you contracted.
Not very efficient or comfortable.
Right. The calumen is typically a fluid-filled space that separates the outer body wall from the inner organs. It acts like a cushion.
He used the analogy of the pericardium around the heart. that fluid sac letting it beat without friction?
Exactly the same principle. It allows internal organs to move and function independently of the body wall's movement. Your gut can churn while your muscles are working to run. It's essential for being an efficient, mobile machine.
Okay, so we have bilateral symmetry, three germ layers, and a hilum.
Okay.
And within this group, Dr. Hoffman explains there are two major developmental pathways.
Yes, the protostomes and the deuterostomes. It's based on what the first opening in the developing embryo becomes.
Protostome means mouth first.
Right. That first pore becomes the mouth. This group includes massive phyla, like arthropods and mollusks.
And deuterostome means mouth second.
Correct. The first opening becomes the anus, and the mouth forms later. That includes echinoderms, like starfish, and importantly, the chordates. That's us.
Two different ways to build a complex body, both obviously very successful.
Very successful, yeah. Just leading to different kinds of animal architecture.
Well, speaking of success, let's talk about the undisputed champions in terms of sheer numbers.
Yeah.
The arthropods. Phylum Arthropoda.
Oh, absolutely dominant. Dr. Hoffman lays out the numbers, something like 1.5 million known animal species total.
Yeah.
And arthropods account for about 1.3 million of those. It's just mind-boggling. Insects, spiders, crustaceans, millipedes.
And the insects alone, class Hexapoda, make up a million species.
A million. It's wild. Think about the diversity just within beetles. It's built on that segmented body plan and the hard exoskeleton made of chitin.
And that exoskeleton, Dr. Hoffman argues, was key to them conquering land, right?
Yes. He makes a really interesting point. Animals, he says, invaded land multiple times. Why? Because many already had structural support endoskeletons or exoskeletons from their aquatic life. They could handle gravity.
Whereas plants had to invent woody tissue from scratch, so they only made the leap once.
Pretty much. Arthropods were kind of pre-adapted for land life in that sense.
But for insects specifically, there's another huge advantage Dr. Hoffman highlights. Flight.
Oh, yeah. Flight is massive, but he points out a key difference between insect flight and, say, bird or bat flight.
What's that?
Well, birds and bats are tetrapods, four limbs. They had to modify two of their limbs, their front ones, into wings. They traded walking limbs for flying limbs.
Yeah.
Insects didn't do that. Dr. Hoffman explains their wings are completely new structures. They're outgrowths of the body wall, not modified legs.
So they keep all six legs for walking, climbing, grabbing things. And they get wings for flight.
Exactly. No functional trade-off. They get the incredible advantages of flight, plus keep all their legs. That's a huge reason for their ecological dominance.
That's a fantastic insight. Okay, let's switch gears to the other big branch, the deuterostomes, and our own phylum, Chordata. We're a minority in species number, but...
But we represent some pretty complex machinery ourselves. And all chordates, Dr. Hoffman reminds us, share those four key features at some point. A notochord.
Which becomes our spine, sort of.
A dorsal hollow nerve cord.
Spinal cord and brain.
Pharyngeal slits.
Gills and fish, parts of our ear and throat.
And a postanal tail, even if it's just embryonic in humans.
Right, so moving within the chordates, a major innovation was the jaw.
Huge. The nathostomes, the jawed vertebrates. Dr. Hoffman stresses how jaws turned early fish from filter feeders or bottom grubbers into much more effective predators. The eating machine got teeth and grip.
And the lineage that eventually crawled out of the water came from a specific group of fish.
The Cercopterygii, the lobe-finned fishes. Their fins were already fleshy and muscular, supported by bone, kind of pre-adapting them for moving along the bottom and eventually propping themselves up on land.
And Dr. Hoffman mentioned Tiktaalik, that famous transitional fossil.
Yeah, classic example. It's got fish features like scales and fin rays, but also tetrapod features eyes on top of its flat head, a neck that could move independently of its body, perfect for poking its head out of shallow water.
You can really see the transition happening there. But those first land dwellers, the tetrapods, were still tied to water, like amphibians are today.
Right. They weren't fully terrestrial yet. Amphibians still need water for reproduction. Their eggs aren't protected from drying out. That dual lifestyle.
So the final piece of the puzzle for true land independence was the amniotic egg.
Exactly. The amniotes, that's reptiles, birds, and mammals. The amniotic egg is like a personal pond for the embryo. It's brilliant.
And Dr. Hoffman broke down those extra embryonic membranes.
Yeah.
The amnion for cushioning.
A lantois for waste storage, chorion for gas exchange, and the yolk sac for food.
Packed with energy-rich lipids. It's a complete life support system.
It totally freed these animals from needing to lay eggs in water, a massive evolutionary step.
Which brings us finally to our own class, Mammalia. defined by?
Producing chew milk and having hair. And Dr. Hoffman contrasted the three main groups.
The monotremes first, the odd ones out.
Yeah, platypus and echidnas still lay leathery eggs, no nipples. They kind of ooze milk onto their fur. Very ancient lineage.
Then the marsupials.
Kangaroos, koalas, opossums give birth to incredibly tiny, underdeveloped young that crawl into a pouch. The marsupium latch onto a nipple and finish development there.
And finally, the etherians, or placental mammals.
That's us. Right. Development happens entirely inside the mother's uterus, nourished via a placenta until a relatively advanced stage, where eutherian mammals, primates, and specifically apes, very closely related to chimpanzees.
It's an incredible journey from a sponge filtering water to,
well,
us. But Dr. Hoffman doesn't end on a purely triumphant note. He brings in the ecological context and current threats.
Yeah, the sobering part. He uses coevolution, like that amazing example of the orchid with the super long nectar spur and the moth with the equally long proboscis.
Perfectly matched.
To show how tightly linked a species can be. But human activities are disrupting these intricate connections.
You talked about overfishing.
Right. And not just depleting numbers, but how targeting the biggest, oldest fish creates evolutionary pressure against growing large and old. It forces fish populations to mature faster at smaller sizes.
Which can really mess up their long-term survival chances.
Absolutely. We're actively selecting for less robust fish populations.
And he made a point about a group we don't often think about as endangered.
The mollusks. Snails, slugs, clams, octopuses. That phylum, proportionally, has the highest number of endangered species.
More than mammals or birds, proportionally.
Apparently so, according to Dr. Hoffman. Mostly due to habitat loss and global change. They're just less charismatic, so they get overlooked. But it's a major conservation crisis for a huge branch of animal life.
So this whole deep dive, tracing these evolutionary steps, symmetry, germ layers, coelomes, jaws, amniotic eggs, it shows how these fundamental innovations built the complexity we see.
Yeah, and all that incredible animal diversity, from the tiniest insect to the blue whale, it's all built on these surprisingly ancient principles. But as Dr. Hoffman makes clear, that very success, that intricate web, is incredibly vulnerable now.
Vulnerable to our pressures over fishing, climate change, habitat destruction, hitting both the incredibly numerous groups like insects, maybe indirectly, and the often overlooked ones like mollusks, and vital resources like fish.
It really puts our own place in perspective.
So maybe a final thought for you, the listener, reflecting on all this. We have these amazing adaptations, jaws, limbs, amniotic development, complex brains that are part of this long evolutionary story. How do those very adaptations connect us to, or maybe even make us responsible for, the crises facing other species who share parts of that same ancient toolkit?